Austrian physicist Erwin Schrödinger created the world's most famous thought experiment in 1935. Here's popular science writer Chad Orzel explaining Schrödinger's cat.
He imagined taking a cat and placing it in a sealed box with a device that had a 50% chance of killing the cat in the next hour. At the end of that hour, he asked, what is the state of the cat? Common sense suggests that the cat is either alive or dead, but Schrödinger pointed out that according to quantum physics, at the instant before the box is opened, the cat is equal parts alive and dead at the same time. It's only when the box is opened that we see a single definite state. Until then, the cat is a blur of probability, half one thing and half the other. This seems absurd, which was Schrödinger's point.
Back in 1976, the state in the Ronnie Long case wanted the jury to believe that this case was a real-world example of Schrödinger's cat. There undoubtedly was significant physical evidence from the burglary and brutal rape in this case that could have been used to incriminate or exonerate Ronnie Long, and yet it was the state's contention at trial that the vast majority of this evidence was never collected or tested. According to the state, the only pieces of evidence collected and tested were the latent shoe print and the matches by the banister at Juddie Bost's house, and witnesses for the prosecution testified that the shoe print and those matches seemed consistent with the shoes seized from Ronnie Long and the matchbooks taken from the Long family car. Any other evidence from the crime scene was a black box, evidence of guilt and innocence at the same time. And therefore, the prosecutor was able to argue during closing that, quote, every piece of physical evidence points unerringly to the fact that the victim told you what happened that night unerringly. 32 years later, that same prosecutor was forced to make an admission under oath. There was in fact a lot of evidence collected and tested in the case, and none of it pointed to Ronnie Long. And yet, even that admission was incomplete because there was still more evidence that wouldn't come to light for another 7 years, and still more evidence that has never been disclosed to Ronnie Long. And while the existence of all this new evidence might lead you to assume that he has been released, Ronnie Long is the actual real-world Schrödinger's cat, still in a box with a legal status perhaps unlike any other prisoner in American history, both innocent and guilty at the same time.
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, the State versus Ronnie Long. This is the fourth and final episode on Ronnie Long, who has been in prison for 42 years based on a burglary and rape in Concord, North Carolina that he says he didn't commit. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan Story, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at theviewfromll2.com. And as you may have heard, we got some big news in the Adnan Syed case, and we'll have an update episode on that for you shortly.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
After Ronnie Long was convicted of rape and burglary on October 1st, 1976, two sheriff's deputies drove him to Raleigh's Central Prison as the Hall & Oates song, She's Gone, played on the radio. He's been in prison ever since. In the past 42 years, Ronnie Long has seen hundreds of other prisoners enter and leave while he remains behind bars.
I'm going on 63-year-old, man. I locked me up when I was 20-year-old, man. And I've been here all since. They got people that have murdered people, man. They killed them. Two, three bodies, and they let them out.
In 1989, Ronnie Long filed a pro se petition for a writ of habeas corpus in federal court, claiming that his trial counsel was ineffective for not challenging the jury selection process, but that petition was denied a year later. Later, he applied to the Innocence Project at the University of North Carolina to investigate his case. The case was accepted, and two attorneys began working on it. Donna Bennick, herself a Concord native who is now deceased, and Janine Zanin. On April 20th, 2005, they filed a motion in Cabarrus County Superior Court. Here's Janine Zanin describing the motion.
We went to the Cabarrus County Superior Court and filed a motion to preserve and locate all the physical evidence gathered in the case, including the rape kit that we suspected had been gathered just based on the testimony at the trial. We were also looking for the victim's clothing as well as the items that were introduced at trial. And the hair samples collected from Ronnie that he had said were collected from him while he was in the jail, as well as anything else that might be out there. And in response to our motion, the court granted it and ordered that the Cavarrus County District Attorney's Office, the Concord City Police Department, and the North Carolina State FBI were under order to locate and preserve not only all of the physical evidence, but also copies of all test results and reports prepared in connection with the investigation of the case, as well as the records of their evidence custodians relating to any evidence that was collected.
A month later, the State Bureau of Investigations, or SBI, it came back and said that it had no evidence related to the Ronnie Long case. The Concord Police Department also said they had no evidence, but they opened the door a crack.
Detective Ledwell testified that no physical evidence was found after 25 man hours put in searching. And then he did say that there was a master case file, and the district attorney at that time represented that she had examined the master case file and that there was nothing of evidentiary value within it, and that there was, you know, nothing that we would be interested in. We then asked the court to please allow us to go and see that master case file anyway, despite the representations that the district attorney made in court, and in spite of the fact that they didn't actually bring it to court with them. And the court allowed us, and shortly after the hearing, it was part of the court's order, we went down to the police department and reviewed that binder ourselves, and were shocked to discover that actually quite a bit of physical evidence had been collected in the case and turned over to the State Bureau of Investigation.
So, despite the claim from the SBI that no evidence existed in the case, the UNC attorneys pushed forward.
We then began our own search to try to find those reports, because we knew that the reports must exist.
And turns out they were right. Their own search through the files produced several SBI files that had never been turned over to the defense, or apparently to the prosecution. The latter part is key because the state tried to claim that it had an open file discovery policy, meaning that Ronnie's defense team had access to everything in the prosecutor's possession. But the prosecutor from Ronnie's trial would testify at his appeals hearing that he had never received any of these SBI reports, meaning that the defense hadn't seen them either. So what happened? The culprit here appears to have been Concord Police Department Identification Officer Van Eisenhower, who failed to turn over the evidence either in good faith or bad faith, but there's every reason to believe it was the latter.
The records that we found, because of course we thought that he was going to testify, so we looked for, we looked at his criminal record. And my understanding was that he was stealing people's benefits checks, or maybe their tax returns out of mailboxes. So he was convicted and pled guilty of possession of stolen U.S. Treasury checks, two counts, and then also pled guilty to eight counts of uttering a forged instrument in state court.
But that's not all. In 1981, Van Eisenhower had his marriage in Virginia annulled upon a finding that he was already married in North Carolina. In other words, Van Eisenhower was guilty of bigamy. But beyond Van Eisenhower's sordid character, there's a more important reason to believe that he withheld the SBI reports in bad faith. They all supported Ronnie Long's innocence.
There is a lot going on in this world, and if you follow me on social media, you know that I think about a lot of different issues, from politics to science, technology, arts, the environment. Well, they're all things that concern me, and to keep updated on these kinds of issues, I'm not just online, I read The Economist, because The Economist is far more than just economics and finance. It actually covers all of those things that I just mentioned. The Economist helps readers prepare for what's going on in the world around them, and in today's dynamic world, well, facts matter more than ever. And for 170 years, The Economist has delivered trustworthy intelligence and facts that help people like you choose where to stand on the issues that matter the most. And because they cover such a broad range of issues, it means there is something in The Economist for everybody. For example, I recently just read an article in The Economist that told me that Americans are actually richer today than they were in the 1970s. And I find this particularly interesting because we hear and have heard a lot about the economic anxiety that's driving some of the politics in this country. So, a great piece with all the facts and figures that I need to inform my own opinions. You can check out this and dozens of other fantastically researched articles by getting your free copy today. To get your free copy of The Economist, all you have to do is visit economist.com/undisclosed. Once again, that's economist.com/undisclosed. The Economist, the smart guide to the forces changing our world today.
The first SBI report dealt with the matchbooks found in the Long family car. Now, to refresh your recollection, the police recovered partially burned matches next to the white banister adjacent to the open window on the second floor of the Bost residence. The state's theory at trial was that the assailant used these matches to light his way in the dark. Five matchbooks were subsequently recovered from the Long family car, and as we noted in episode 2, Lieutenant Vogler testified as follows at trial.
The matches we found at Mrs. Bost had one side was, to my recollection, was sort of a blue on one side and maybe natural grayish color on the other side. And the matchbooks we found in the car contained the same type of match.
Now, what the jury didn't hear was that SBI Special Agent Rick Cohn had done a forensic comparison of the matches from the crime scene and the matchbooks taken from the car. His conclusion was that all but one of the matchbooks could be eliminated as the source of the matches based upon color characteristics. Finally, Cohn concluded that he could not completely exclude the fifth matchbook as the source of the crime scene matches in this basis, but did conclude that those matches, quote, probably did not originate from this matchbook.
The second report dealt with the second piece of forensic evidence presented against Ronnie Long at trial. As we noted last episode, SBI agent Dennis Mooney testified that he compared a latent shoe print lifted from the banister at the Bost residence with two ink impressions that were made from Ronnie Long's shoes after they were taken by Van Eisenhower before arraignment. Mooney testified at trial that he compared the shoe prints using, quote, caliber biters, oblique lighting, and a visual examination, and concluded that Ronnie Long's shoes could have made the shoe print on the banister. Now, this sounds pretty scientific, and it was important because the prosecutor was later able to claim during closing arguments that, quote, the man that made the footprint is the man that broke into her home. What the jury didn't hear was a full lab report he prepared in conjunction with the testing. It stated,
the shoe track impression submitted in item number one above was examined and noted to contain a partial shoe track impression. The known shoe track impressions submitted in item number two above were examined and compared with the shoe track impression represented on item number one above and was noted to be of the same tread design. There were an insufficient number of distinct characteristics noted by which to affect any identification. It is this examiner's opinion that the two known shoe track impressions submitted in item number two above could have made, and that's underlined, could have made the shoe track impression represented on item number one above.
Could have made, but didn't necessarily make. So all the talk about using caliber biters and oblique lighting to compare the shoe prints, it was hot air. There were an insufficient number of distinct characteristics to compare the prints, so Mooney just eyeballed it and determined that sure, it was possible the long shoe could have made the shoe print on the banister. Colin asked Jamie Lau, Ronnie's current attorney with the Duke Innocence Project, about the significance of this report and the shoe print comparison.
The report itself, I think, suggests that it's even more problematic even to suggest that the latent lift was from Mr. Long's shoe. So, of course, that's important. However, with respect to the latent shoe print, I think any credence to the testimony regarding it at this point in time has to be, you know, there should be zero reliance on anything suggested by that shoe print, because the latent comparisons in this manner has more or less proven to be unreliable over the course of time, and there's no scientific validity to making these comparisons.
Lau was referring to a body of research that includes the 2016 report by PCAST, the President's Council of Advisors in Science and Technology, which concluded that, quote,
there are no appropriate black box studies to support the foundational validity of footwear analysis to associate shoe prints with particular shoes based on specific identifying marks. Such associations are unsupported by any meaningful evidence or estimates of their accuracy, and thus are not scientifically valid.
Janine Zanon would certainly agree with this analysis because she was especially unimpressed with the ink impressions they made of Ronnie's shoes and then compared with the latent shoe prints that they lifted from the crime scene.
Have you seen it?
I have, yeah. I have that in the file.
I mean, it's like the bottom of a hush puppy shoe, like maybe like at the center of the, I don't know. To me, it just looked like a bunch of scratchy lines, and I don't know how anybody could identify that against anything, and against a shoe that was probably worn by half the people in Concord at the time.
And then there's a third report, the one that dealt with hair evidence. Back in 1976, SBI agent Glenn Glesny did a microscopic examination of the following evidence. Item number 4 was a known hair sample from Ronnie Long, from his comb. Item number 5 was a package of pubic hairs taken from Ronnie Long. And item number 9 was a hair taken from the bottom of the staircase in the Bost residence where the sexual assault took place. The report calls this hair, quote, suspect hair. Item number 10 was a plastic bag of known pubic hair taken from Bost. And finally, item number 13 was a plastic bag of clothing that Bost was wearing at the time of the assault. Here is Glesny's conclusion.
Microscopic examination and comparison of the hair found at the scene in item number 9 showed it to be different from the suspect's hair in items number 4 and number 5. No hair or hair fragments similar to the suspect's were found in the victim's clothing in item number 13.
In other words, the suspect's hair was not similar to Ronnie Long's hair, nor were any hairs or hair fragments that were recovered from the clothing the boss had been wearing at the time of the assault. Beyond the obvious exculpatory nature of this evidence, Janine Zanon sees a possible link between the suspect hair and the hair in the lime green toboggan that Ronnie Long says did not belong to him.
And then I guess the other interesting thing to me that was really frustrating about the toboggan and the hair in the toboggan, mm-hmm. and there's a connection that I see there, is that, so Donna Bennick and I went down to the courthouse and looked through the clerk's evidence file from the case and handled the toboggan. And just as it says in the record, the trial transcript, there is a light-colored hair in there, but I would say not just a light-colored hair, but a light-colored hair that looks like it came from a light-skinned African-American person, because it's that texture, right? It's like this short, very kind of curly hair that doesn't look like it came off the, you know, the typical Caucasian head. And then there's that coupled with the description of the hair that was found and tested as against Ronnie's at the FBI, which was also described as a lighter color hair, but yet could have been Negroid, or, and then I think they wrote Native American, crossed it out and wrote Mongoloid. And Jenny Bost's initial description of her attacker as like a high yellow, light skinned black man, which Ronnie is not. And so, I mean, when I look at all of that, that's all consistent with the same perpetrator who's not Ronnie.
A fourth report dealt with paint and fiber evidence. Back in 1976, SBI agent Cohen examined and compared the following evidence. Item 1 was the lime green toboggan taken from the Long family car. Item number 2 was the pair of black gloves taken from the car. Item number 3 was a black leather jacket that Ronnie had borrowed from his friend, Terrence Docks. Items number 6 and 7 were carpet fibers taken from the areas of the Bost residence where Bost said the assault occurred. Finally, item number 8 was paint taken from the white banister the state claimed the assailant climbed to enter the open window. According to Agent Cohn's report,
examination of the clothing in items number 1, number 2, and number 3 failed to reveal the presence of any fibers or paint similar to those in items number 6, number 7, and number 8, respectively.
In other words, there were no paint or fibers from the Bost's house detected on the toboggan, gloves, or leather jacket.
We're never going to agree on everything, but I think we can all agree we could all use more sleep. Getting a great night's sleep is easier and more affordable than you think. You don't need a new expensive mattress or sleeping pills. You just need to change your sheets. That's why you should check out Boll & Branch. Everything Boll & Branch makes, from bedding to blankets, is made from pure, 100% organic cotton, which means they start out super soft and they get even softer over time. You buy directly from them, so you're essentially paying wholesale prices. Luxury sheets can cost up to $1,000 in the store, but Boll & Branch sheets are only a couple hundred bucks. Everyone who tries Boll & Branch sheets loves them. That's why they have thousands of five-star reviews, and Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, and Fast Company are all talking about Boll & Branch. Even three U.S. presidents sleep on Boll & Branch sheets. Shipping is free, and you can try them for 30 nights. If you don't love them, send them back for a full refund. But I doubt you want to send them back. There's no risk and no reason not to give them a try. To get you started, right now my listeners get $50 off your first set of sheets at bollandbranch.com, promo code undisclosed. So go to bollandbranch.com today for $50 off your first set of sheets. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com, promo code undisclosed. bollandbranch.com, promo code undisclosed. So Donna Bennick and Janine Zanin took this new evidence and filed a motion for appropriate relief in Cabarrus County Superior Court on August 27, 2008. Their claim was that these SBI reports and test results were material exculpatory evidence under the Brady Doctrine, undermining confidence in the jury's verdict. An evidentiary hearing was held in the motion, and you can probably imagine how it went. With regard to the matchbooks, the defense claimed that Agent Cohen's report directly contradicted Lieutenant Vogler's testimony that the matchbooks found in the Long family car contained the same type of match as the matches found by the banister. The state responded there was no expert testimony regarding these matches at trial, and that Vogler's matchbook testimony wasn't central to its case. With regard to the shoe print, the defense claimed that Agent Mooney's report, indicating there were indistinct characteristics to make a comparison, undermined his testimony at trial that Ronnie Long's shoe could have made the shoe print by the banister. The state, of course, responded that Mooney gave weak testimony at trial that Long's shoe merely could have made the print, with Mooney acknowledging on the stand that several other shoes could have made that same print. With regard to the paint and fiber report, the defense expert testified, one, that the assailant's clothes likely would have picked up carpet fibers given the violent nature of the sexual assault, and two, that the white paint in the banister was cracking and that one would expect to find traces of that paint on the assailant's clothes. The state, meanwhile, countered that Ronnie Long's clothes weren't seized until 15 days after the assault, meaning the clothes could have been washed or subjected to weather conditions that could have removed the paint and carpet fibers. Finally, there was the hair report. The defense expert testified that you would have expected to find at least one of the assailant's hairs on Boss's clothes, given the violent nature of the assault, and contended that the suspect hair not being a match for Ronnie Long was highly exculpatory. The state's expert contended the assailant might not have shed any hair on Boss's clothes, and that the suspect hair could have come from someone else who had been in the home, or possibly even a dog.
Ronnie is referencing Agent Glesny's description of the, quote, suspect hair in his SBI report. It describes that hair as black-human negroid, black-heavily pigmented, dash, but sort of a brownish-gray color under full light of microscope. Human-scale structure. Medulla seen, less than one-half diameter. Negroid-kinky-flat or oval. Now, let's remind you of the significance of this issue. Judy Boss testified at trial that she had never had an African-American person in her home and that no African-Americans were members of the community groups that she was a part of, including the church group she had attended earlier in the day. If this hair, which the SBI determined was a suspect hair, was the hair of an African-American person, it is highly likely that it belonged to her assailant, and we know that hair did not belong to Ronnie Long.
Finally, on February 20th, 2009, Superior Court Judge Donald Bridges issued his opinion. Here is the pertinent part of that opinion.
The defendant has failed to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that his due process rights have been violated under Brady v. Maryland, and that he has not shown by a preponderance of the evidence that the claimed evidence was withheld by the state, that it was exculpatory, or that the result likely would have been different with the claimed evidence.
The immediate thing that jumps out is that Judge Bridges applied the wrong standard. Under Brady v. Maryland, the Due Process Clause places an affirmative obligation on the state to disclose material exculpatory evidence to the defense. Now, evidence is exculpatory when it is favorable to the defense, and courts have used two similar standards to define materiality. One focuses on whether the undisclosed evidence would have created the reasonable probability of a different outcome at trial if it had been turned over. And the second standard, which North Carolina courts have used, focuses on whether the undisclosed evidence undermines our confidence in the jury's verdict. Here is the key part of the Supreme Court of North Carolina's opinion in State v. Williams, which was issued about 2 months before Judge Bridges' opinion.
Evidence is considered material if there is a reasonable probability of a different result had the evidence been disclosed. Materiality does not require a demonstration by a preponderance that disclosure of the suppressed evidence would have resulted ultimately in the defendant's acquittal. Rather, defendant must show that the government's suppression of evidence would undermine confidence in the outcome of the trial.
In other words, Ronnie Long did not have to prove by preponderance of the evidence that it was more likely than not that these undisclosed reports would have produced a different outcome at trial. All he had to do was prove that these undisclosed reports undermined confidence in the jury's verdict. And yet, Judge Bridges rejected his Brady claim precisely because he failed to satisfy the wrong standard, the preponderance of the evidence standard. Now, Colin asked Janine Zanin about her take on the ruling.
I think the court applied the wrong standard. I think the court took the DA's standard from her motion papers, which was the incorrect standard, and decided that rather than a finding that all of this evidence that we found gathered together, had it been disclosed to the defense, would have undermined confidence in the outcome of the trial, which would have been the correct standard. Rather, he applied the standard because he did not believe that the evidence would have produced a different result at trial, which is, I think, a higher standard.
But Ronnie Long had another bite at the apple. He could appeal to the Supreme Court of North Carolina, and he did. At the time, the dynamics of that court were similar to the dynamics of the current U.S. Supreme Court. It's well understood that Justice Kennedy is the swing vote in our country's highest court, and that convincing him can turn a 5-4 loss into a 5-4 win. There were 7 justices on the North Carolina Supreme Court, and Benick and Zanin recognized that 3 would probably rule in favor of Ronnie Long, and 3 would probably rule against him. That left a swing justice, coincidentally named Justice Brady. According to Zanin, we felt certain that Justice Brady held the deciding vote, and much of the oral argument was focused on securing his vote.
These days, you can get practically everything on demand, like our podcast. Listen whenever you want, when it's convenient for you. So why are you still taking trips to the post office to mail letters and packages when you can get postage on demand with Stamps.com? With Stamps.com, you can access all the amazing services of the post office right from your desk 24/7 when it's convenient for you. You can buy and print official US postage for any letter, any package, using just your own computer and printer. And the mail carrier picks it up. You just click, print, mail, and you're done. It couldn't be any easier. Now, for the past few months, I've been working on a case that involves arsenic poisoning, and that's involved me sending letters to various agencies. And Stamps.com has saved me so much time and made my life so much easier. And now, as a listener, you can get this special offer. It includes up to $55 with free postage, a digital scale, and a 4-week trial. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage and type in undisclosed. That's Stamps.com, enter undisclosed.
So, oral arguments were held in March of 2010, and Justice Brady's term would end in January 2011. After oral arguments, spring turned to summer, and summer turned to fall, and fall turned to winter. Ronnie Long was still waiting for the court's opinion. Finally, it was January 2011, the last month in which Justice Brady could take part in the opinion. It didn't come. Justice Brady's term ended, and he was replaced by Justice Barbara Jackson. Finally, the next month, the opinion was issued, in February of 2011. Three justices voted to give Ronnie Long a new trial. Three justices voted against a new trial. Justice Jackson, who wasn't present for oral arguments, declined to take part in the opinion. But to get a new trial, Ronnie Long needed a majority vote. Instead, he got a tie. And this is why Ronnie Long is the real-world Schrodinger's cat. There is a seventh justice, Justice Brady, the swing vote, who was the focus of the defense's oral arguments. Presumably, after oral arguments and 10 months of work on the case, he'd formed an opinion on it. And yet, we don't know that opinion, and probably never will. Indeed, we don't even know which justices voted for or against a new trial or why. Here's the long and short of the court's opinion.
Justice Jackson took no part in the consideration or decision of this case. The remaining members of the court are equally divided, with three members voting to affirm and three members voting to reverse the order of the Superior Court. Accordingly, the order of the Superior Court is affirmed.
Needless to say, Janine Zanon was unimpressed with the court's actions.
I think it was an extraordinary moment of cowardice on behalf of the court as a whole, knowing that justice was retiring and not getting to finalize the opinion until that justice retired, and then waiting until afterwards to issue a 3-3 tie that also allowed the justices to issue an opinion without naming which justices fell on which side, you know, affirm or overrule the trial court's decision. I think that demonstrates some cowardice by all of them. Nobody wanted their names associated with it. It's mind-boggling to me that you could look at the real doubts that I see when I look at this case and want to sidestep it and not make a decision.
But this situation with the Seventh Justice isn't the only Schrodinger's cat in this case. During their search for evidence, Bennick and Zanon discovered the existence of one more piece of evidence. They learned that a rape kit was done on Bost, with no less than 5 samples of bodily fluids collected. The records show that Marshall Lee of the Concord Police Department picked these samples up from the hospital on April 26, 1976, just hours after the assault. But there's no record of where the samples went after Lee picked them up. They're missing and might never be found. Now, you might wonder, was the state's failure to preserve this vital evidence, which so easily could have proved Ronnie Long's innocence or guilt, grounds for a new trial? Well, unfortunately, we're back in Schrodinger's cat territory. The U.S. Supreme Court has distinguished between failure to preserve apparently exculpatory evidence and the failure to preserve potentially exculpatory evidence. To explain this, imagine that there's been a bank robbery, and the defendant in the case is a 6-foot-tall African-American man. Now, assume that there is surveillance camera footage of the robbery, and a police officer took notes while watching the video, writing down that the robber appeared to be about 5 feet tall and Caucasian. If that video subsequently got lost in good faith, such as being destroyed while trying to make a copy, there would be a due process violation. That's because the video is apparently exculpatory, meaning that the exculpatory value of the video is apparent from the police officer's notes. And the failure to preserve apparently exculpatory evidence is a due process violation regardless of the good faith or bad faith of its destruction if the defense is unable to obtain comparable evidence. Conversely, here in this case, there is potentially exculpatory evidence. This is evidence whose exculpatory value is uncertain when it goes missing. The key Supreme Court case on potentially exculpatory evidence is Arizona v. Youngblood, in which the state failed to refrigerate a young boy's underwear and t-shirt after he was sexually assaulted. While both contained semen stains, the lack of refrigeration made successful testing impossible, and therefore it was unclear whether those stains would have proven the defendant's guilt or innocence. As a result, according to the court, there was no due process violation.
In an opinion filed with the clerk today, we hold that unless a criminal defendant can show bad faith on the part of the police, failure to preserve potentially useful evidence does not constitute a denial of due process of law. Here, the police failure to refrigerate the victim's clothing and to perform certain tests on the evidence can at worst be described as negligent.
The same went for Ronnie Long. He was, however, given partial relief in his appeal. We discussed the case of James Tyrone Woodson in Episode 2, in which the Supreme Court held that North Carolina's mandatory death penalty was unconstitutional. That decision spared Ronnie Long's life back in 1976, and it gave him a shot at release in his later appeal when it was used again to convert Ronnie Long's two life sentences for rape and burglary into a total prison term of 80 years, meaning he's now eligible for parole. But parole seems unlikely for the reason you might expect.
You know, we had been working with him a little while as he was coming before the parole board a number of times, and he was specifically told by the parole board on one occasion that he would greatly increase his chances of parole if he would enroll in the sex offender program available through the prison. But step one of that program is admitting your guilt, and he continues to maintain his innocence, and I believe that he's innocent, despite the fact that if he would just even fabricate and say that he did it, he could probably be out of prison at this point. I mean, the man's been in prison for over 40 years. It's time for us to find the truth. And I believe that the truth is that Ronnie Long did not commit this crime.
Bennick and Zanon didn't give up after the state Supreme Court ruled against them. Instead, they took Ronnie Long's case to the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission. We've talked a lot in this podcast about conviction integrity units formed in prosecutors' offices to review cases of possible wrongful convictions. The first CIU was started in 2007, and the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission is sort of a proto-CIU that was formed the year before and is independent from a prosecutor's office. Here's Lindsay Smith, the current executive director of the commission.
So our commission is made up of 8 members. By statute, it is required to be a Superior Court judge, who serves as our chair, a district attorney, a defense attorney, a victim's advocate, a sheriff, a member of the public who isn't an attorney and who isn't involved in, like, the judicial branch, and then 2 discretionary members that are chosen by the Chief Justice. They can have any background.
When a case is submitted to the commission, they conduct an initial investigation phase, in which they're looking for new evidence that proves or could prove the claimant's innocence. If there is new evidence, the commission moves to a second stage, known as the formal inquiry phase.
When there is some new evidence that's kind of there and it looks like we might want to put that case to a hearing, we move into what we call formal inquiry. This is the stage at which we're required to notify the victim that we're looking at the case. So this is kind of reserved for a small number of cases where there really is something there that might be considered new evidence that could be put forward. Once we're in a formal inquiry, we complete that investigation. It doesn't really look much different than an investigation in terms of the types of things we're doing. We're still doing interviews or finishing up testing and that kind of thing. And then if it is deemed that there is new evidence that needs to be presented to our commission, we hold a hearing before the 8-member panel.
At this point, for convictions after jury trials, if a majority of the commission believes there is significant new evidence of innocence, the case is sent to a 3-judge panel. In the Ronnie Long case, there was new evidence. 43 pieces of new evidence. And yet, the case was not sent to a 3-judge panel. By July 30th, 2015, Jamie Lau of the Duke Innocence Project had taken over Ronnie Long's case. On that date, he received a letter from the associate director, Sharon Stellato, denying relief to Ronnie Long. Here's the pertinent part of that letter.
At the commission's request, Concord Police Department located 3 envelopes of latent prints from the crime scene in this case. These latent prints were analyzed by an independent expert. The expert excluded Mr. Long and several alternate suspects as the source of those latent prints. Concord Police Department uploaded 4 latent prints to AFIS, and the queries returned no possible contributors. Copies of latent examiner report and the AFIS report are enclosed with this letter. In Mr. Long's case, the commission determined that there is no DNA testing that can be done that might establish actual innocence. At this time, there is no other credible and verifiable evidence of innocence on which the commission can proceed. His claim will not be considered again unless there is new, verifiable, credible evidence that has not previously been considered by a jury or a judge. closure of Mr. Long's case by the commission does not impact his right to pursue other post-conviction relief.
So there are two huge pieces of news here. First, 7 years earlier, the Concord Police Department had been ordered to turn over all of the physical evidence they had in the case, and there was no disclosure of these fingerprints. And there were a lot of them. According to the Concord Police Department evidence processing report, there were three envelopes containing latent fingerprint list cards. The first had 9, the second had 22, and the third had 12. None of them were a match for Ronnie Long. As you might expect, Ronnie Long wasn't thrilled with this delayed disclosure.
The DA stands before a Superior Court judge and lied, saying that I had all the evidence that they had, that there was no more evidence in this case. A Sergeant Ledwell from the Concord Police Department also testified that there was no more evidence. And then in 2015, in 2009, they testified that there was no more evidence.
We have 30 seconds remaining.
But in 2015, I come up with 64 fingerprints that were collected from the crime scene, and now one matched my prints. My prints were nowhere in this house.
Second, the report indicates that the fingerprints were tested against Ronnie Long and, quote, several alternate suspects. But who were these alternate suspects? Jamie Lau followed up with the commission and they told him there were 6 alternate suspects. One of these 6 was mentioned in the police files, but the other 5 were never previously disclosed to trial or appellate counsel. Now, you might recall that Judy Boss was shown 13 photographs of African-American men soon after she was assaulted. It turns out that 3 of these men were actually part of the 5 previously undisclosed alternate suspects in the case. Clearly, then, there was some evidentiary basis for considering these 3 men as alternate suspects and not the other 10 men in the lineup. And then there were the last 2 undisclosed men who presumably became alternate suspects based on evidence collected after the night of the assault. The disclosure of these fingerprints, of course, prompts at least 3 additional questions. First, where were they lifted from?
There is some indication in the material that the Innocence Inquiry Commission provided with respect to where they were lifted, but there's no, as is typically the case, there's no photos identifying where they were collected from. There's just some general descriptors for each latent lift.
Second, were these prints put into the national system for possible contributors? Lau was given an evidence processing report from the Concord Police Department indicating that they had submitted the fingerprints to AFIS, the Automated Fingerprint Identification System, for possible nationwide matches. That report indicates that one of the fingerprint lift cards had, quote, insufficient value for submission, and that the other 2 cards, quote, returned no possible contributors of the latent impressions. According to Lau, this report raised some serious concerns. Here's Lau explaining those concerns to students in Collins criminal adjudication class just last week.
The database always turns possible contributors. It's up to the analyst to determine whether or not the possible contributors returned by the database are in fact a match to the print put into the database. So you set the database to return the number of potential matches you want it to, and it will always return people because it's just doing a scoring comparison, and it will give you the highest scores, which are the highest likely matches. So this is not a valid result. We looked into this a little bit, and we found out that the agency, the Concord Police Department, who stands to lose a lot if Ronnie Long's ever exonerated, because they're the ones who are responsible in many ways for his conviction, the agency had only had the system these fingerprints were queried through for about 3 months at the time this query was done. They had no standard operating procedures guiding their use of the system at the time these fingerprints run. And because of that, that makes a lot of sense why they put a response into the report that's impossible given the system. We did a public records request for their standard operating procedures. And in response to that, we got a Word document, which was great, because then we just looked at the metadata on the Word document that said it was created that day, and then they had to admit that they only created it in response to our request for the standard operating procedures for the lab. The other thing about it is it said that our standard operating procedures is to apply the operating procedures that the State Bureau of Investigations uses when they run fingerprints through a system. And you go to the State Bureau of Investigations procedures, and this is not a valid response per the State Bureau of Investigation procedures. So if they were in fact using those operating procedures, they would not have reported that the query returned no possible contributors. Further evidence that they were absolutely rudderless when they were querying these fingerprints through the system.
And then, of course, there's the third and most obvious questions. Why were these other men considered alternate suspects? Here's Jamie Lau.
The Innocence Commission indicates to us that the bulk of its investigation was reliant on the files of the Concord Police Department and the Cabarrus County District Attorney's Office, which was a red flag that there were additional files that we've never seen, because suddenly there are new names of alternate suspects that have never been provided to Mr. Long before.
So Lau made an understandable request to the Innocence Inquiry Commission, where, by the way, he actually used to work. He asked them, please turn over your files pursuant to a protective order so we can see what's going on here, and we promise not to disclose those files to anyone else. The commission's response was that they had no problem with complying with this request, subject to one condition.
The Innocence Inquiry Commission had indicated a willingness to provide us its files under a protective order, but they would only do so if the prosecution agreed, and the prosecution said that they would not agree to our having the files even under a protective order, limiting our use to in-court proceedings in Mr. Long's case.
So, yeah, after about 42 years in prison, Ronnie Long still doesn't know the exact locations of 43 fingerprints lifted from the crime scene, whether those fingerprints were correctly submitted to AFIS, or why several other men were considered alternate suspects in his case.
Finally, around the same time that Ronnie Long's case was submitted to the commission, it was also submitted in federal court. In 2012, Long's prior attorneys filed a petition for writ of habeas corpus in federal district court, claiming the North Carolina courts applied an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law in denying his Brady claim. And based upon what we discussed before, they were obviously correct. In the Supreme Court of North Carolina opinion we cited that was issued months before the same court addressed his appeal, the court cited the United States Supreme Court opinion in Kyles v. Whitley for the conclusion that Brady does not require a showing that proper disclosure of withheld evidence would have produced a different outcome at trial. Therefore, the North Carolina courts clearly erred in denying Ronnie relief based upon the finding that he failed to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that disclosure of the SBI reports would have led to the jury acquitting him. So what the North Carolina courts did in this case is entitled to no deference, and the federal court should simply have to decide whether those reports undermine our confidence in the jury's verdict. But here we are, 6 years after Ronnie Long's filing, and no federal court has reached the merits of his claim. Why? As we noted before, back in the 1980s, Ronnie Long had filed a pro se habeas petition, meaning that his second habeas petition was what's known as a successor habeas petition. And because Ronnie's attorneys didn't seek permission to file a successor petition, the district court dismissed that petition. Well, after Jamie Lau learned of this new fingerprint evidence, he filed a third habeas petition, this time with the permission of the court. The district court, however, denied the petition, finding the fingerprint evidence was new evidence that the North Carolina state courts hadn't yet considered, meaning that Ronnie had to go back to state court and litigate or exhaust the issue before returning to federal court. The defense appealed this ruling to the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, using an argument similar to the one we covered in our Terrence Lewis series, that the fingerprint evidence was being used to prove actual innocence as a gateway to revive the previously defaulted Brady claims based upon the undisclosed SBI reports. And without getting into the weeds of this claim, we can simply say this. It worked. Here's Jamie Lau.
So we appealed that decision to dismiss on the basis of failure to exhaust to the Fourth Circuit, and the Fourth Circuit reversed and remanded the decision of the district court and sent the case back to the district court for continued litigation, which is where we currently stand. We're back in the district court after the Fourth Circuit reversed and remanded the decision to dismiss Mr. Long's case from district court on the basis of failure to exhaust. And we're hopeful that the district court will now provide us with an opportunity to litigate the case in the federal district court and will agree with us that the Brady violations were egregious violations of Mr. Long's rights.
This opinion by the Fourth Circuit was issued on October 25th, 2017, and Lau's hopeful that a hearing will be scheduled in district court in the next few months, with a federal judge finally ruling on the merits of Ronnie Long's claims. So let's briefly assess that claim. At trial, the jury heard Juddy Bost's unquestionably shaky eyewitness identification, which was bolstered by the shoe print comparison, the matchbook comparison, and the toboggan gloves and jacket allegedly recovered from Ronnie Long. And that evidence allowed the jury to convict, despite several alibi witnesses accounting for Ronnie's whereabouts throughout the day. What the district court now has to decide is whether the previously undisclosed evidence, in totality, undermines our confidence in the jury's verdict. This is that undisclosed evidence. The SBI agent's report that no shoe print comparison could be made. The other SBI agent's conclusion that the matches from the crime scene didn't come from the matchbooks in the Long family car. The absence of paint and carpet fibers from the Bost residence on the toboggan gloves and jacket. The absence of Ronnie Long's hair on the victim's clothes. The suspect African-American hair from the site of the sexual assault that was not a match for Ronnie. The 43 fingerprints that were not a match for Ronnie. And the existence of six alternate suspects. Janine Zanin and Jamie Lau clearly think that this standard has been met. Colin reached out to Cabarrus County DA Roxanne Vanikoven for her take on the case, but she never responded. Here was her response when Kayla Ayres was covering the case for Fox 46 Charlotte.
Now, just hours ago, the Cabarrus County District Attorney responded to my multiple requests for comment, writing in part, quote, "I have thoroughly reviewed the case, personally met with the victim, and analyzed the changing story of the defendant. I stand by the jury's verdict. Moreover, I stand by the victim who never wavered from her identification of Ronnie Long as her brutal rapist."
Colin asked Jamie Lau about the statement.
Mr. Long's story has been consistent from the very first day. That day, he went to a planning party for a class reunion. Later on, he was at home for a period of time where he spoke on the phone to the mother of his child, and then he was later at a party that night. Numerous people had seen him throughout the day, can verify his whereabouts throughout the day, and did so at trial. The suggestion that his story has been anything but consistent is simply an effort by the state to mislead and misdirect individuals as to the strength of the evidence in its case. Any review of Mr. Long's account of that day would have to acknowledge its utter consistency in what it was that he was doing on that day.
And so, about 42 years after first being locked up, Ronnie Long waits. His most tireless defender is his wife, Ashley, who researched his case, concluded that he was an innocent man, and fell in love with him while visiting him in prison. Here's a clip from a news story by Stuart Watson about their marriage.
He's a great man, and I fell in the process of helping create awareness for his injustice. I fell in love with him. I think it could be positive, because I also think it would bring attention to his case.
Why do you believe Ronnie is innocent?
Because I've seen the evidence with my own eyes, and I've also asked him myself, face to face. You know, I go visit him every single week, and we speak multiple times every single day. You know, Ronnie can call me. He calls every morning and calls throughout the day. He can call me and say, "Can you do this?" And I get it done. I mean, I stop everything I'm doing and get it done for him. I've sacrificed everything and put him first, because that's what he needs to get out. He needs to be put first. You know, people on the outside looking in just can't understand it, you know, and what matters is that Ronnie and I have an understanding.
But over the years, he's missed a lot. The 2-year-old son who talked with him on the phone on the night of the assault, possibly even at the exact time of the assault, is now a father himself, with 2 kids of his own, one of them older than Ronnie was when he was first arrested.
I usually don't show emotion. 9 times out of 10, I use jokes as a defense mechanism. I'll probably crack jokes here and there. If you see me crack a joke, 9 times out of 10, my feelings are hurt. So I'm, by me not having Ronnie around, it's tough. I kind of need him here. I really do. I really need him here, because it's a lot of things that I can be able to sit down and talk to him about without having I can have an unbiased opinion about things that's going on with myself. But the way it makes me feel is I really need him here is tearing me down too. Just to hear him say that he's broken down breaks me down.
In speaking with Ronnie, you get a sense of his anger and also a sense of his fighting spirit. That same spirit that led him to turn down a plea deal all those years ago that would have had him home in a few years. And yet, you also get a sense of his weariness. You can almost hear the toll that the years of being wrongfully in prison have taken on him just from his voice.
I have been done wrong. I have been done unjustly for 42 years. And when is it going to stop me? When is it going to come to a head to let me know that the dog is holding this man down? Let me go home. I done missed my dad is dying. My two sisters is dead. My mom is 87. I mean, I done missed raising my son. My son is 45 years old now. He got two daughters, my two granddaughters. I ain't never spent no time with none of them. Here I am now. 42 years I've been taken from me. Then what am I supposed to do? They turn me loose into the street right now. 62-year-old. And what kind of life am I supposed to have? The system that they have here in the state of North Carolina is set up for you to fail.
And yet, you get no real sense that Ronnie or the people around him will ever give up. And with the recent ruling of the Fourth Circuit, they might be in the best legal position they've been in for years. There's no guarantee that Ronnie Long will ever be released, but there's now a guarantee that his case will be heard. And not in the North Carolina courts that have denied him relief for decades, but in federal court, probably later this year. This ends our arc in the Ronnie Long case, but it doesn't end our work on the case or our reporting on it. We'll continue to update you on his status as his case winds its way through the courts.
Now, as Susan said earlier, and many of you may have heard, we got a big ruling in Adnan's case last week. Keep your eyes peeled and your ears open for an extra bonus episode of Undisclosed dropping tomorrow, in which Susan, Colin, and I go through the new ruling and what it means for the state versus Adnan Syed. Next time on Undisclosed.
Wallace Long's lawyers have said that their client is innocent of rape. Well, now they have found new evidence that could prove it. And as News Channel 36 I-Team reporter Stuart Watson found out, they are asking for a new trial.
Tell me how to why. Keep from facing time in prison. When everything is set for the evidence, say I did it. The jury thinks I'm ignorant. Your word against the witness. The judge only see me as another stupid nigga. Hey, but order in the court.
A big thank you to everyone who has helped make this episode and this series possible. A big thank you first to our sponsors who help bring us back week after week and bring these stories to you. Thank you to our fantastic executive producer, Mithil Thelhan, to Baluki for designing our logo, to Chrissy for maintaining our website. A special thank you to Henry Lavoie for research on this case. And if his name sounds familiar, that's because he's the son of Rebecca Lavoie. Yes, the Lavoies are mightily talented. Rebecca is our fantastic audio producer and the host and co-producer of one of my favorite podcasts, Crime Writers On, which if you have not listened to, please do check it out. And finally, thank you to Jay Trinity, who produced the credit song in this case. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Our Twitter handle and Facebook is at Undisclosed Pod. And if you have questions for the addendum, don't forget to get our producer attention by tagging them with hashtag UD Addendum. Thanks so much. Until next week.
The case divided Concord along racial lines. After the verdict, white police beat black protesters with billy clubs and maced them in the courthouse. Protesters threw rocks and set fires.
What kind of justice could I receive, you understand, under these type circumstances?